Hi friends, happy Friends of France Tuesday. In today's episode, it might seem like we'll be talking about babies, given her title, Bed, Bath, and Beyond, the baby. Don't you like that title? But actually, we'll be talking more about the process revolving around the mom, who actually did all the work, FYI. First off, side note, Bed, Bath, and Beyond. I remember when my mom used to go to these stores when I was younger, and she just spent hours in the store looking for new curtains, blankets, and hand soaps while I'm playing Pokemon in my Game Boy. PTSD, somewhat. Actually, is Bed Bath & Beyond still open? Are they still around? Anyway, what's still around is my actual trauma related to the baby, and I'm talking about childbirth. During nursing school, I got to witness vaginal births and cesarean sections as a student, and can I say that my mouth hung open wider than the mom's cervical dilation. I'm sorry, but there I said it. I was just both horrified and in awe of the whole process. For one specific mom I will never forget, they actually had to perform an episiotomy, or an incision on the tissue between the mom's vaginal opening and anus, because the fetus was too big to pass through. Girl, I mean, I am not a girl. I don't have a vaginal opening that would ever require an episiotomy, but I felt it within my soul. I was just cringing the whole time out of pure visceral, or more of vicarious agony. And the whole time I was just like, how do people go through this? How do people just experience this in pure daylight? One thing I also cannot forget from nursing school is during my maternity or OB class. One page of our textbook included a chart of how uterine size increases throughout each month of pregnancy, and seeing how by the third trimester, or 28 to 40 weeks, the uterus has enlarged to about the size of a watermelon, which reaches almost the bottom part of the chest. Like, excuse me? And obviously, as a male nurse, I work with predominantly women, many of who have gotten pregnant. And I just witnessed their episodes of hyperemesis or vomiting, nausea. Oh my gosh, people who are pregnant go through so much for about 9 months, not including the whole recovery process after childbirth, not even just the physical changes, but also the many unsaid things like postpartum depression and baby blues. Superheroes, literal superheroes. And we cannot even give just a maternity leave here in the United States. Well, our topic for today is a bit of a hit on the American system, in a way in that we can go back for a quick bit to the realm of traditional Chinese medicine, to talk about quite an old practice regarding women after childbirth, postpartum or postnatal confinement, or zuo yezi, where the mom does nothing for a whole month, a whole 30 days and nights, and sometimes longer, but recover and rest and heal. What a concept. Have you ever heard of this practice before? Well, we'll learn all about that in today's episode. And I'm so honored to introduce to you our expert guest. Honestly, the best we can ask for in this topic. She is a leading authority in postpartum wellness, a physician, and a mom herself, Dr. Crystal Lau. Actually, our special visitor from Europe. Dr. Lau is the award-winning author of the book Postpartum 30, the founder of Bridgeson Health and Mama's Wing Women, a consulting company that creates wellness experiences for individuals and families and provides postpartum planning, coaching, and wellness programs to new parents and their families. Icon. She has a master's in public health and healthcare organization and policy, and served as the advisor and co-chair of the Women's Health Lifestyle Medicine Initiative at European Lifestyle Medicine Organization, or ELMO, postnatal retreat development consultant at SANU, family resiliency expert at the United States Army, hello, and director of education at the Military Birth Resource Network and Postpartum Coalition. She has also been featured in Medium, Goop, KDLA News, Exilion Magazine. I mean, hello? Icon all around. So it's such a biggest honor to introduce Dr. Lau for our today's episode. Are you ready? Okay, let's get to learning. Imagine if skincare could do more. But with less. Meet Remsen, a New York brand made in South Korea, where world-leading innovation meets the no-nonsense energy of New York City. Their essential duo keeps it effective and efficient with high-quality ingredients. Their Gentle Greens Cleanser, featuring green tea, centella, and aloe, cleanses without drying. And the multitasking peptide moisturizer combines bakuchiol, ceramides, and a clinically proven dose of peptides in a single lightweight step to hydrate, strengthen the skin barrier, and help prevent visible signs of aging. Both are safe for sensitive and acne-prone skin types, vegan, cruelty-free, and beautifully packaged with sustainable materials, making the set a great gift. You can get 20% off your first purchase on remsenskincare.com. That's remsenskincare.com with the code FRANZ. That's FRANZ. One-time use and cannot be combined with other codes. Get maximal results with minimal steps. Hi, everybody. Welcome to Friends of FRANZ podcast season 4. So honored to be joined today by someone who is so multifaceted. And by the way, I just checked, we first contacted each other online on November 10th, 2023. So as you know, this took time and fate for it to happen. I'm joined by such an amazing person who inspires me so much. I catch myself, probably stalker vibes, but reading her on Google searches like every here and there, because she's just so inspiring. I mean, she's a physician, an award-winning author, consultant, and leading authority in postpartum wellness and culturally sensitive postpartum care. And I think one of her biggest prized possessions is being a mom, which ties in a lot to our conversation today, Dr. Crystal Lau. Crystal, thank you so much for joining me.
Well, thank you, Christian. I can't believe 2023. I felt like it wasn't too long ago, but maybe that's the either age or the mom or the parent perception of time doesn't really flow like other people's, I guess. But yeah, thank you so much for that lovely introduction. I stalker vibes probably for me too, because I look at what you're doing and I'm like, I love how you have your clinical side and the other part of you, this, your fashion stuff and everything else you're doing. And I'm like, I love that you're able to do both and you show up for them both. And even with your academic research background, that is so amazing. I really love everything that you do as well.
Thank you so much. You know, I thought there was a time where, especially in social media, they're always talking about niches for you to grow. Like, oh, you have to do this and stay in this one hole or this one cup for you to succeed. But I'm like, what if they want to be this and that? And I think that's true about life too, right? Like so many things can exist at the same time. And I think it's kind of like a foreshadowing to our conversation of two things existing in the same time, and specifically within the realm of healthcare and medical practice in itself. I think one of the most exciting things that we talked about during our first video call was when you mentioned to me about both like a Western type and Eastern type medicine. It's right across each other, building wise, and they're like referring to each other. And I think that really encapsulates the idea of what I had for this fourth season of the podcast. And like I said, during our introduction before we started recording, I'm quite nervous for this season because I don't know how my audience, they're quite loyal, thankfully, and also scarily. They're quite loyal, but it's also interesting to see how they will be receptive to this. And I think you encapsulate the season. Like, I'm so grateful that we met. Thank you, Asian Hustle Network.
Yes, shout out.
And also a shout out to them, because I think half of my guests from the first season were all from Asian Hustle Network, and we're back in full circle. So you encapsulate what the season's supposed to be, because you have the expertise of a physician, but you're also trying to input these traditional and cultural parts and aspects of a very specialized care that, especially here in America, we are very pharmaceutical and very lab-based driven, that we might not be open to it. So in today's episode, I'm definitely going to nitpick your expertise and your brain in this area. But before all of that, I do believe that the things that we pursue in life and probably the professions and the careers that we have decided to partake roots a lot in our childhood and our experiences. So I wanted to dive deeper first into your background and tying that into the endeavors and the pursuits that you have today. What made and what makes Crystal Lau?
Oh, that question. I love how you phrased that. It made me feel so special. Thank you. No, you're right. I think the childhood thing really, the experiences that you have, you know, and had absolutely shapes your perceptions, your beliefs, your values, your compass. A lot of what guides me today is things that either I've experienced before and feel. The big part you said East and West was, so I'm Malaysian, born and bred. I only left Malaysia in my early 20s when I did a twinning program medical school. So I did medical school first in Malaysia, and then I finished off in Australia, and I started working there. And during that time, it was a struggle for me because when I grew up in Malaysia, we use Western medicine and Chinese medicine for me. And then you've got my Indian friends, some of them use Ayurveda as well. Now with the Malays, they also have sometimes their medicine person that they go to. But everybody uses both. And it was never a thing of, you know, as like my parents and my aunts and uncle, one was better than the other. It was a feeling of like, oh yeah, you know, you got a fever, you got a sore throat. You know, we understand that you could have a viral infection or maybe strep throat or something. So you go see your family doctor. And then if you need antibiotics, they'll give that. But at the same time, they'll take us down to KL Street at the time. And you have these uncles with the Chinese herbs on the thing. We used to queue up in the roadside in the middle of the night to get a bowl of soup. And you just scoff that down and go like, all right, we'll see how I feel the next day, or come back for a second bowl of soup the next night. And using Chinese herbs, it was all hand in hand with paracetamol, antibiotics, or whatever else you needed. So I found that that part of me was, I had to choose when I started training in, I guess, allopathic medical pathway or Western medicine, whatever we want to call that. I really felt a sense I had to choose even back in Malaysia. It was to a point where, you know, the image of Chinese medicine, Ayurveda, was woo-woo. And the perception of the message you got was Western medicine is superior. If you follow the other or you try to incorporate that, then you're not a good doctor, you're woo-woo. That was the vibe that I got. Whether it was overtly said to me or not, I honestly don't remember, but that's the vibe. And that kind of caught me. I wasn't comfortable, I gotta say, for a while. So it took me a few years in Australia, the first couple of years, to be even comfortable to even recommend like honey and lemon drink if someone has a sore throat and tries to ask me for something. And I said, really, I think all you need is just a good bowl of chicken soup, add some herbs if you want, take your teas, rest and see how you go. But there's a chance, you know, for example, things could progress to maybe a pneumonia or something because infections can get worse. So just watch out. Like, it took me a while to be comfortable to say that. So yeah, I would say in my childhood, that part really guided me towards where I am today. I would say actually, I have actually left clinical medicine for a good 8 years at least now, but it still feels so fresh. I think some things don't leave you once you enter that world, right? All the skills you pick up, I would say that I am here where I am today because of going through med school, actually doing the medical work, honing those skills that you say that right now I take back those feelings that I had of, you know, feeling like I wasted or, oh, if I didn't do medicine and jump straight into business, maybe I could have gotten further, but probably not because we never know. So I do feel like I am where I am today with the attention that I got for the niche that I am, postpartum wellness or confinement care, because I've kind of used everything that I've got with the also life experience that I had and put it up to where it is right now. Yeah,
definitely. And quite curious, how did all of that allopathic training and all of those exposures to both Western and traditional medicine lead you into this place now of postpartum care? I want to know exactly that moment back in time where there was the inflection point of, this is what I want to do.
So the thing is, a lot of us from, I would say East Asia, because, you know, China, Japan, Korea, Southeast Asia, everyone there, those of us who have lived there, grown up there, when someone says, for example, I had friends come to me when I first got pregnant, my first child, I was like, Crystal, are you going to do confinement? And I was like, yeah, of course I am. You know, like everybody would try their best to do it, even though we've migrated to the West. So what that means is, of course, I've come to realize also in a lot of Western countries, when someone say confinement, it sounds like incarceration or jail time or something like that. But to us, confinement is very specifically linked to postpartum rest, whether it's doing the Chinese style, the Malay or the pantang for the Malaysians. And I know Indonesia, they also observe pantang. So the English translation is taboo. So essentially, there's a lot of cultural family superstition as well rooted in this kind of practice. But we'll get to that, where there's differences between, I guess, the traditional medicine practice part and cultural beliefs and all that. So I thought, yeah, you know, I wanted to do that. But we were in Alabama at the time and there's nothing there. I was like deep South Alabama. So there was nothing much. I couldn't have access to anyone, you know, who had Chinese medicine or herbal knowledge. So actually, we had to travel to New York for me to go and see a Chinese medicine practitioner there. And then we brought back 30 days worth of herbs in a luggage bag just to prepare for my 30 days of rest. So at the time going through that, I was actually looking for resources more to read up because I am what in Malaysia we call as bananas because I don't speak the mother tongue very well. Of course, Malay, English fluent, but Mandarin, very little. Cantonese, I can order food and swear at you probably. That's about it. But I realized that a lot of the resources out there were either TikTokers or social media people who've covered their stay in those postnatal retreats or confinement centers, people who talk about their personal experience. And the books that are available are mostly recipe books, again, with a lot of very familial type of snippets in it, but nothing quite like what I was looking for. Kind of how do I make this make sense in Alabama when I can't, you know, I was lucky to be able to fly my mom in. But what if I didn't? Then how could we have done it? How could I have made sure I ate the food well? How could I have made sure I rested? And all those things, I was kind of unsure. So when I did that, I thought, oh, and then found out we were having a girl. And suddenly that urge kicked in, like, I have to pass this down. I was like, I need to compile this. So I thought of doing a scrapbook at first, very simple scrapbook that, oh, you know, it's a rough thing. I could hand it down to my kids. But then I started talking to my friends and they were kind of had also similar questions to me, like, well, why do we do these things? Why do they say don't wash your hair for 30 days? Why do we only eat foods? Or why do we hear for some confinement nannies in East Asia who, you know, there's a whole business around this. Why do they, you know, tell moms, don't drink water, only drink teas and soups? So I couldn't really find the answers at the time. I didn't know enough people in Chinese medicine as well to ask those questions. But yeah, so I thought a scrapbook would be good to pass down. And then it kind of went into the cycle. The more people I spoke to, the more. And then again, Asian Hustle Network, thank you. Because I remember February of 21, I remember because I started writing my book just about the time I found out I was pregnant with my second child. We were in Germany already at the time. And I asked the question there and the responses were amazing, Christian. People were like, we absolutely want to know more. And I was like, okay, I guess I will write a book rather than just a scrapbook for my kids. And that's how it all started. I never envisioned I would take this to the level of today where the book, you know, won an award or to Yay. Be able to talk. I know that to me was mind-blowing. Long way to answer your question. The merging was I realized also a lot of public health advancements we have today kind of answered why certain practices were done that way ancient times, because people back then didn't have the technology or the health sanitation and things like this. So they had to create ways or rules to ensure that the moms back then had a better chance of survival. You know, maternal and infant mortality rates way back when was just so high. That's why I guess men had many wives, because yeah. Many of us, you know, many women passed away in childbirth and babies didn't make it either. And, you know, we have a lot of us Asians, whether you are, I guess, even Japanese and Korean, you have a variation of that full moon or baby's 100-day celebration as well. Because, again, infants back then probably didn't make it past. Yeah. So for, you know, something so traditional back then was to celebrate like, wow, you made it past your third month of life. There's so many of these things that when you look back and you relate it to health is because people back then didn't have the means, didn't have the science, so they did their best to preserve, I guess, health practices in the form of tradition.
We long for what's natural, yet often hide it with layers. And today's soap market is no different, crowded with products that are harsh and overly processed. Born in Seoul, South Korea, Chai Minu was made to bring things back to something simpler, something intentional. Each handcrafted bar of soap is cold-processed in small batches, using only natural oils and botanical powders. It is then cured and air-dried for over 1,000 hours, letting the bar harden naturally for a gentler feel and a longer life. It all began with a mother searching for relief for her son's sensitive skin and her refusal to settle for harsh liquid soaps or quick-made bars. Such her skin experienced a byproduct of patience, simplicity, and a mother's love. For 15% off at shybinu.com. That's shybinu.com with the code FRANZ. That's FRANZ. Sometimes, all it takes is a spark. Something crisp, bold, and refreshingly different. That's where Sanzo Sparkling Water comes in. Founded by Queens-born Filipino-American Sandro Rocco, Sanzo has a simple goal: to bridge cultures and invite communities to explore and celebrate bold Asian flavors by celebrating unique Asian fruits, made with the real fruits themselves, clean ingredients, 100% natural sweeteners, and without artificial additives. Whether these flavors are a taste of home or a source of discovery, Sanzo is excited to bring you authentic flavors in the most delicious way they know how. So go ahead, pick your fruit, lychee, yuzu, mandarin, and much more, and get 10% off your first order at drinksanzo.com. That's drink, S-A-N-Z-O.com, with the code FRANZ10. That's FRANZ10. Valid until December 14, 2025, and limited to one use per customer.
Definitely, like utilizing what they have at that point in time to reach a quality of health that probably was not attainable at that time because they didn't have the medical technology or probably even the fount of knowledge that we have now, right? But that's not to say that they are not able to stand on their own grounds, these traditional practices that have been around for like thousands of years, right? And specifically, you were mentioning that the idea of confinement and the practice of confinement is really the inflection point to leading into not only the book, but to your expertise in this postpartum care. And this was the topic that when we talked for the first time in our video call, what really intrigued me the most, because I frankly don't know if I knew about postpartum confinement way back when. I think it probably was mentioned once in my nursing textbook. But again, I went to nursing school in America. So the only thing that we learned is definitely from not only the physical health practice, but the fact that the mom holds the baby and then we make sure the baby's okay and the Apgar scores and all of that.
Apgar scores,
but then when you messaged me and you were telling me about postpartum confinement, I was like, what is she talking about? As you were mentioning it, it really brings me back to our first conversation and really the intrigue in me of like, wow, such an, I would say, ancient practice, right? Traditional practice that people like you are trying to keep alive and invigorated up to this day. And I really wanted to dive more into that because that really is the start of where our conversation today. Please lead us into the practice of postpartum confinement. What is it? What are the origins? What's the premise of this quote-unquote not incarceration?
Absolutely. Like, I mean, I would say the biggest documentation comes out of China, of course. I mean, if you just think back of history, China was huge as an ancient empire itself. So a lot of the scholars, a lot of documentations, you know, would come from then. Because you notice now in America, a lot of the postnatal retreats are led by Korean-American women. So Koreans have their own practice called Sanu Joriwon, and I had the amazing chance to work with Sanu in DC. Julia Kim is her name, amazing woman, CEO of Sanu, and we worked together because we shared a lot of visions for postpartum care. So what was interesting, I would say, when I dived into, well, of course, I had to find, I guess, English translations of Chinese texts so that they publish on those open source academic portals. But what I found back then was a lot of the practices came, it depended on which dynasty was in power, because then the imperial doctor would kind of dictate what that practice meant at that time. So right now in the modern times, families practice between 30 days and 40 days of rest, which is immediately right after the mom has her baby, the birthing parent has their baby. So in Asia, if you have the money, you would immediately check into a confinement center or postnatal retreat, and you actually pay for the whole 30 days. That is a booming business. You could pay easily five figures to stay there, but you get three meals a day prepared specifically for nourishment rejuvenation after childbirth, and you get training on baby care. There's nurses to help or nannies to help with the baby as well. Some of them even tag team with clinical people to come in, you know, just help the mom check on her and things like that. So full-on service. And some of us do it at home, which is also great. And this is when the family really comes together, and usually the matriarch of the family, traditionally, it's the mother-in-law. And there is a reason for this, because again, back in the ancient days, it is the interest of the mother-in-law to look after her daughter-in-law after she gives birth. Why? So that she can produce more babies for the son. So sometimes I feel like, yeah, there is a very patriarchal vested interest in this whole practice if we think about it that way. But I think as time has passed, it's become more of a, it's for me, the mother, for me to get back on my feet, not bounce back, but to get back on my feet at the initial part, because the rest of the journey of my postpartum journey is going to be pretty challenging. So that initial first part of recovery after childbirth is important. And I would say from the text that I've looked at, the duration of confinement could easily be 30 days, even 100 days, some even up to a year. And that was actually written in the academic paper. And I was like, okay, it makes me feel better because it shows that even back then, it kind of was up to whoever was in charge to decide on the duration, which meant I was like, that actually empowered me to rethink how I want to approach postpartum. And that's why a lot of the other things I'm doing now, actually out of confinement, I start to realize that our Western side, we don't have really a actual program or guide really for when you, like you said, when the mom goes home. And I've noticed that even in Australia, even in Europe, where policies are in place for maternity care and they have midwives, nurses, or even health visitors in the UK who visit the mother, but a lot of the women I spoke to in this region still said it wasn't enough. So that made me kind of wonder, like, okay, you have your policies in place, you have the clinical support in place, but then I realized that it's because the day-to-day challenges, the day-to-day adaptations that comes especially for first-time parents, those resources are still not accessible to everyone because not everyone can afford it or they don't have enough people providing those services. And also a lot of our society now, we unfortunately don't trust each other as much anymore, which I don't blame society as a whole for that. So I just realized that, okay, there is a space for a traditional confinement approach, even in the modern sense, both in a way of giving our modern postpartum care something extra to get. For me, it's bridging the gap between you leaving home at the hospital and that 6 to 8 week OBGYN checkup, that time in between. Because after that, that kind of rolls into the rest of your postpartum journey where other types of support need to kick in. But that initial first part where, especially after the C-section, mm-hmm. if there is a, you know, traumatic or complicated vaginal birth, that rest time is just so important to set the mother up for like maybe rehab with pelvic floor or something down the road. Like if you don't rest enough, and this is my gripe, having done medicine and specifically I did geriatrics quite a bit. So Australia is different. We kind of do all sorts of specialties before or departments before you actually specialize. And I spent a fair time in ortho geriatrics as well. And I'm like, there is literally programs for the 80-year-old frail person that you knock and hack out of their hip. But I'm like, where is that for moms though? If you think about it, we don't do that for maternity at all. And not you're right. All. Things you learn in nursing school. I mean, I can look back at OB, my GYN term. A lot of acute, of course, postpartum hemorrhage was huge, preeclampsia, eclampsia, all those big things. But in postpartum, what I remember is mostly an emphasis on postpartum depression, which we still do today, which I'm going to put on the record, probably the first time I'm saying this out loud, to be honest, is I absolutely detest that the word, when you tell someone postpartum, the automatic association is postpartum depression. It's not. To me, it simplifies the whole thing into a mental health. It is a problem, yes. But the reason that for me, I think the problem still is there and worsening is because we're continuing to see it from that lens and you're not seeing it as a rich, complex experience that it truly is. And the other thing is as well that I believe in the way, so a lot of my postpartum work, I started as volunteer on base because it was a bit hard to work in Germany and do all that stuff. So on base, I did my best to do postpartum workshops and wherever I could get a platform to talk about this stuff, I would. And every time I talk about it, I talk about the mom and the father or the non-birthing partner as well, because I cannot address maternal health if I don't talk about the partner as well, assuming they have a partner, right? And also depending, like some people live in multi-generational households or they have other children, or some of them have pets that they just adore like their other child. You have to take that whole unit into account when you talk about postpartum, when a new baby comes in the family. You can't just say, I'm just going to look after mom and baby and that's that. But you forget that they're going home to live with all these other people who also have a role in that change of family dynamic. They're starting to question, well, what is my role now that baby is here? So to me, you have to talk about postpartum on a much bigger scale. You have to widen your lens. And the cultural part, one thing I like about how I'm doing it is I'm making it part of that whole experience, then it doesn't matter which culture you come from, you can have that person. And I would say for a lot of women, and I think for a lot of us who, I never thought I would be so into my traditions, to be honest, until I was pregnant, then something kicked in and suddenly you have this urge to want to pass things down, to preserve, and you realize like, oh, it's kind of hard to adapt a lot of our traditions to modern living. But yeah, there's always a way to do it.
Yeah, I think the preservation of these practices and these worldviews when it comes to not just pregnancy portion, but not just the postpartum portion, but also, you're right, the whole union itself and the family and even friends. You're right, I have friends who give birth and I'm like, baby's cute, but can I hang out with just you too? And so I wanted to ask, in relation to that and confinement, how does the whole unit, the family unit, and especially even the partner, if they are present in the story and the picture, how do they contribute to this practice of confinement? Like, what are the elements of confinement? I know you were mentioning how it's about rest and really allowing the mother to, what did you say, not bounce back, but to...
Yeah, it's not about bouncing back, because I hate that. I never bounce back, but it's just preparing them for that next step.
Yeah.
In the rest of the postpartum journey, because it's all about rejuvenating, regaining your energy. No, I love the question you asked, because this is where the things I've learned about the Chinese medicine perspective of postpartum. One of my friends, well, now a friend, her name is Shana. She runs, at this point, I think the only or the first Chinese medicine maternity clinic in Singapore. So she specifically does a lot of breastfeeding care. And she was also a nurse in her past life, so to speak. She's a theater nurse, and then she kind of went and did Chinese medicine. And she does a lot of Chinese medicine confinement in Singapore. What she's told me, and also I kind of dived into a little bit in some of the English Chinese medicine books to understand a bit, postpartum physiology. This is something I even asked around. What is postpartum physiology? And no one could give me an answer. There are no textbooks on this. There's nothing up to date. I mean, they have like, oh, you know, kind of what happens, but mostly most research is up to 6 to 8 weeks. And I'm kind of like, guys, it has to be more than that. Even the Lancet in December 23 has said that long-term effects of childbirth is way past 6 to 8 weeks, sometimes even more than a year plus, but we don't have enough research, not surprised there. So the idea is, from the Chinese medicine perspective, is during childbirth, the body is depleted of everything, which makes sense. You're sweating, you're crying, you're in pain, blood loss, fluid loss. You're giving your all to bring life. Like, if you just stop to think about that in itself, like, wow. Just even for that moment. So of course the body is depleted. They say the qi is depleted, the blood is depleted. And one thing that I found very fascinating, which answered my question of, well, why do I always have to keep warm and not wash my hair and all these things during the time, is the Chinese medicine principle perspective is the channels. We have channels in our body that specifically in childbirth, they all open up wide. So you want to prevent what they call external factors from going in, like wind or dampness, because if those channels close and you didn't get rid of those external factors, then they circulate in your body and they can cause things like arthritis. That is the Chinese medicine kind of postpartum physiology, which I was like, that's why my mom says keep warm for the 30 days. Don't wash your hair, because the channels are also up there and you want to keep your head dry so you don't have cold air and dampness going in. And so when you recover and everything closes, you don't get this lingering wind in your body that can give you arthritic pains when you get older. And one thing I've heard a lot in the Chinese medicine aspect to do confinement is to also preserve the woman's health, so that when we get to our elderly age, we are not suffering from ailments that we picked up in childbirth recovery. I love that, because I'm like, yes, to my geriatric side, I'm like, yes, 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 we need this, because long-term effects in childbirth, and you know, we can imagine for, I think Germany and France, definitely certain, the part of their gold standard postpartum care is pelvic floor rehab, or at least access to a physical therapist to assess if you need rehab or not. That's not really existent everywhere else, which I really feel that should be worldwide a gold standard after childbirth. So that's the Chinese medicine aspect, which I think is actually a very nice merge with a lot of our Western approaches to postpartum. I really think that it's a nice bridge, because when we help moms recover and then they do rehab or anything else they need, they're going to reap so much more when you can get that initial part kind of rejuvenated.
Yeah, definitely.
Which is why the practice in itself, traditionally, a lot of men were excluded. different provinces in China, though, some of the men participate very actively, which means that they are the primary caregiver of the wives after childbirth. So they cook, they clean, they do everything for her. And the idea of resting for the mom during this time is not just physical rest, but mental rest. So don't ask her to project manage anything. Don't ask her where the stuff is. Don't ask her, what's the recipe.
What a foreign concept in America. Please, you could never here in the United States, which is amazing, right? And because if you think about it, based on everything that you're saying, based on everything that we do know is true, is the amount of physiological changes, not only postpartum, during and after childbirth, but throughout pregnancy, right? The hormones influx and depletion, rest time deficiency for those who have like hyperemesis gravidarum, right? Everything is just haywire. I feel like pregnancy is just one of those phenomenons in life and in the body where I see my friends who are pregnant and like we're having lunch and the next thing you know, her whole disposition changes. In my mind, I'm like, oh, she's going to throw up. And so what I'm trying to say is it is so much and as much as joy and fulfillment and reward, I'm sure the end point is the amount of trauma it places in the body, it's just given that you should have rejuvenation and you should go through a resting period after such, I don't want to use the word grave, but such a grave moment, right?
That is. I mean, it's one of the most dangerous things a person with a uterus could go through is to grow and then birth a baby because, I mean, even for myself, I didn't know this, but second time around, I had to do an emergency C-section, which is like my ultimate nightmare come true, that one, which, because I was on the end in my OB term, I was the first assist in like my, I don't know, my first 2 weeks in OB or something. I absolutely despise surgery. Sorry to all you surgical peeps out there. It's just not my thing. I would avoid the theater like the plague, but man, you know, I had to sit in the room for a while after that and be like, I will never, ever volunteer for a C-section in my life. If I have to have one, I'm just going to cry. And I did when it was my turn.
Oh my goodness. And also,
yes.
Side note to my uncultured Americans, theater is operating room for all of you out there. Earlier when you said that your friend was a theater nurse, my American kicked in and I was like, she worked in the theatrical arts as a nurse? I was like, oh no, wait, it's operating room. Because one of my cousin in London is a theater nurse, actually.
Okay.
But yeah, no, you're right. It's like the amount of trauma, especially for cesarean section. The first time I saw it, I literally was like, thank God, and this is of no offense, thank God I cannot get accidentally pregnant. Oh my gosh.
No, you know, I think, Christian, let's not apologize and let's say it as it is because pregnancy is harsh, okay? Yes, the end point, and this is where I want to encourage women, right? Mothers, birthing parents who may not feel the full sense of fulfillment or joy after, that's okay because that was me too. But this, again, I love that you bring up childhood. This ties back to all. Can I swear on this podcast?
Yes, please.
All this shit we were brought up with. I had pretty terrible postpartum depression. I was on meds even until after my second pregnancy. Probably when my second kid was 1 year old was when I finally weaned off and, you know, everything was fine. But it's just all these things from childhood. And you think you may have dealt with it. I thought I did. I thought I'm confident. Like, I love myself, blah, blah. But gosh, as soon as I held the baby and like, gone home and reality kind of set in and that whole postpartum, everything set in. I was like, okay, I am not enjoying this. Like a lot of mothers say that they are. I'm like, where is that oxytocin kick? Where is that love? I'm not feeling it, which was probably a precursor or rather a signal that, okay, we could be talking about postpartum depression here.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I've had, when I nursed my child as well, for both of them, I had this thing called dysphoric milk ejection reflex, EMER, and I didn't know what it was. Never heard about it in med school, nothing. And thankfully, my lactation consultant I had in Alabama was fantastic. So I told her, I said, I feel just this sense of doom every time I nurse, like literally every time the milk letdown happened. And I was like, what's going on? It felt every time like, oh, a truck's going to crash in a house or a sinkhole's going to open and eat the house. Like I felt that amount of panic or anxiety every time I nurse. And my kid was like on me every 2 hours. So it was so overwhelming emotionally to get that weird hair on your back kind of feeling. And she told me, she's like, oh no, you have DMER or DMER. And I was like, what is that? Can that be cured or whatever? And she's like, I'm sorry, there's no... It's like, at the time, she said, we don't know that much about it, except that instead of your brain releasing all the love, it releases anxiety every time you nurse.
My goodness.
And I was like, what? And she's like, yeah. And then I developed postpartum depression. But bear in mind, though, those of you who go read up or you might have it, DMER does not mean you have postpartum depression. Like, it's not directly linked, at least not that they found lately. It's a completely separate thing. But I've noticed even when I was on my antidepressants, it didn't really make that feeling go away. It was just there. I just had to learn to recognize it and deal with it and just anticipate that feeling of doom every time I nurse my kid, like, a few times a day, every day. And I still nursed her for like a year and a half, though.
Yeah.
But I've known women who stopped because of that.
What if your night out could come with a smarter tomorrow? Meet Dayguard, a Korean-inspired functional jelly stick designed to support liver health, hydration, gut balance, and vitamin replenishment when drinking alcohol. With science-backed ingredients like DHM, L-cysteine, prickly pear extract, L-arginine, and B vitamins, each convenient and delicious stick helps your body break down alcohol and reduce next day sluggishness. Just take one stick before your first drink of the night and support your body's natural recovery so you can wake up refreshed. Get 10% off your first purchase at dayguard.com, that's dayguard.com, with the code FRANZ, that's FRANZ. One-time use and cannot be combined with other codes. What if your home could feel more like you? Meet Emmy, a New York-based home fragrance brand founded in 2020 by Erica and Mark. Inspired by the scents they grew up with, like steamed rice, tropical fruits, and temple incense, Emmy celebrates fragrance as memory, culture, and ritual. From design-forward candles to reed diffusers and hand soaps, each product is crafted with clean ingredients, woodwicks, and thoughtful formulations. More than scent, Emmy creates atmosphere and belonging, storytelling in wax, in water, in air. So whether it's lighting a candle or washing your hands, small rituals are transformed into something intentional, making your space warm, alive, and entirely yours. Get 15% off at emmynyc.com. That's emmynyc.com with code FRANZ. That's FRANZ. Find your story. Find your atmosphere. Find it with Emmy.
This is why, like, amalgamating all of these things, it's so important to really place a highlight on the care in postpartum, where the first term that we think of is postpartum care, postpartum wellness, and not postpartum depression. Yet, definitely, it still doesn't erase the fact that postpartum depression or PPD does exist and continue to increase in prevalence, right? Is it because of how we practice medicine or how we approach pregnancy and postpartum, especially in the United States? I wanted to bring up this statistic that according to a study published in JAMA Psychiatry or Journal of American Medical Association, approximately 1 in 7 women in the United States experience postpartum depression to some degree. And additionally, according to an article in the International Review of Psychiatry, 30 to 75% of new mothers experience the baby blues within the first 2 weeks of childbirth. But I know that you've mentioned that you have gone through postpartum depression in itself, which obviously is multifactorial. We can't allocate it or allude it to just one specific reason or one specific cause, but definitely it's a mixture of so many things, right? Just definitely there might be a genetic predisposition to it. But
yes,
also,
yeah,
for sure, it's just the whole trauma of not just childbirth, but also, I mean, I stub a toe and I'm like, just kill me now, please. But I can't imagine of like, also, I just wanted to mention too, when I was during nursing school and during maternity class, when they were talking about how much the fundus can stretch up to here, to the xiphoid process, I'm like, I remember my reaction was like, literally, because I cannot make it out, probably because I could never experience it. So I'm like, they had this graphic of how much the fundus increases.
Yeah.
And I'm looking at all of I'm gonna look all of my friends who are girls, and they're like, what's going to happen to me? So I feel like all of those, like, humor aside, all of that included, and definitely, again, the inflections in the hormones and neurotransmitters and the stresses in itself, like, you know, not just the physical aspect, but also the logistical aspect of money and the finances of having a new kid. Mm-hmm. You know, in the United States, this great country of ours, does not have a federal law that mandates paid maternity leave. I mean, there is FMLA that provides up to 12 weeks of unpaid leave per year for certain family and medical reasons. And the average maternity leave in the United States is 10 weeks. So when you were talking about, you know, we have studies from 6 to 8 weeks, but the effects could go up to 1 year, even to the point of a chronic, right? Of chronic illnesses,
chronic,
and chronic conditions. When you think about this in hindsight, or not just even hindsight, in a very overt view, you're leaving women to no payment for just up to 10 weeks, but then the effects of pregnancy can last even up to a year. And then we have this whole conversation on postpartum depression and, again, of all this need for rejuvenation. Like, what the heck is going on? Like, no wonder our mothers
are statistics, yes.
Hello.
I mean, to be honest, I think if we reframed postpartum as a whole and everything as a men's health issue, we'll get somewhere pretty quick. So on that note, paternal postpartum depression, absolutely a real thing. Well-researched? No. Because we don't invite men, specifically males, and even I would say for same-sex couples who have babies, who on earth looks after the overall well-being and then mental health of the partner of the mothers? We don't have any wellness checkup for them. They are starting to attend antenatal cares. Nobody asks them how they're doing, especially your first-time dad, or even if you're a dad, you know, a parent of two and you're expecting number three. We laugh at them when they faint in the birthing room, which I personally used to think it was funny. But looking back, I'm like, okay, that's just mean because they are never prepared in any way. Men before them never modeled, or very few modeled, nurturing, caregiving type of roles. So I would say that I actually feel really upset for a lot of fathers today because we don't have a space for them. And that's why it's so important for me in, you know, even the cultural practice, even in my book, I go against it. And I say that I really think that partners should be the main confinement support person. Or if you're a man, confinement manny is a word we like to use. Hey, this is the thing, you know, when Henry Golding was expecting his child, I think his wife was like, oh, my confinement manny. And everyone was like, ah, so great. But I think that's wonderful. And I think they should, because that early time, again, goes back to everyone's trying to find their place. And like you said, males, you can never experience what pregnancy is like and what it's like to give birth. But you're there, and there's also, you said, trauma. There's also trauma for them to watch this. And this is the thing people don't see, is that when, especially for couples, when that mom, that birthing parent goes and does all these things, we are still at a point today where there's a chance one or both lives could be lost. And that person could go home with no family. If you just stop for a moment to think of that, that's scary as hell. That's just scary as hell. Or if this is the second and third time, and the problem in America that we've seen the news, many fathers have gone home without their wives. Let's just not cry here, but seriously. But what support is there for our fathers? Who's screening them? Some, I mean, there's studies who are doing the Edinburgh Depression Scale on dads and all that, but it's not talked about enough. There is no guideline to say that we got to check in on the partners and the spouses.
Yeah,
but
I never thought of it that
you
way.
Should. You have to. You have to, because it's the whole unit. And so when you ask back, so how can partners play a role in a confinement practice in a modern setting? So of course, we don't follow traditionally that, oh, it's not a place for men. Screw that. It absolutely is. If some provinces in China do that, you can do it too in America. And so this is where I would say for a lot of men in your childhood, you may not have learned some of these things to care and nurture for someone because you were just never exposed to that. But this is the chance to learn. So if you hire a doula or a confinement nanny, because those antenatal classes, I think they're great. But honestly, who the heck's going to remember that one's baby is here? Like, everything's just out the window. So postpartum planning is so important. So for me, when I do confinement for the people I work with, I always do confinement and postpartum planning, which has to happen during the pregnancy. You cannot do planning when baby is here because it's just chaos. And I know America has a big emphasis on birth plan because that's what I experienced as well. But nobody in hell talked to me about postpartum plan. Nope. I know it's a thing that the doula community covers. So that's why I would recommend in the States specifically, hire someone, even if you can't afford to hire them for the whole time, but even if it's to help that non-birthing parent to learn how to do these things, it's worth it because these are the skills you're going to need after the 30 days. Like if you're doing the cultural practice, you know, you're going to cook, you're going to go shopping, you're going to clean the house, you're going to clean the baby or wash the baby. This is the time mom is also establishing the breastfeeding. So all these things I talk about DEMER, it's worth noticing. And like you said, baby blues, it's very commonly because of all the hormonal ups and downs. So it usually happens after 2 weeks of giving birth and it should last usually about 2 weeks and kind of go away by itself. And that's why the postpartum depression diagnosis, they kind of say, you know, you got to let that early time pass and then watch for worsening, you know, but sometimes it can be really bad. Then that's something you should really engage your health provider immediately rather than wait. And this is why, again, this cultural practice, it fits so nicely in even in our modern setting. Because it fits in that jigsaw piece between the birth and the 6 week. So I think when we can adapt something like this in the modern side, you get, I would say, a safety net. So by the time they see you at, you know, the clinician at 6 to 8 week, you kind of, you know, maybe when they do the depression scale, it might turn out better. I don't know. We don't have enough studies specifically for the confinement care. They are very mixed results, to be honest. Also very small samples in those studies. But because the cultural aspect involves a lot of your parents coming to live with you, that in itself can affect mental health greatly, adversely, sometimes positively, depending on your relationship with the parent. So I think a lot of those confounding and things we need to really, it'll probably be quite challenging to do a clinical trial, to be honest, to really measure this appropriately. But end of the day, the demand is there. And because the practice involves a lot of hands-on from, I would say, a helping support person to really let mom rest. Because, you know, we give her the advice that, oh, you should only lift something as heavy as your baby, especially after a C-section. So she shouldn't be doing chores. She shouldn't be going out to do groceries. She can go out for a walk, which is absolutely good for the mental health. But from the confinement side, my mom would not like that. But I told her, I'll make sure I bundle up, you know, I'll cover up then. And that's actually my Chinese medicine practitioner friend said, she's like, oh, of course you can go out. Just, you know, don't expose yourself to too much cold. Or if it's summertime, you don't want to be overly sweating because then that depletes your body. You want to be at a nice, moderate kind of situation. And most importantly is the food. So a lot of doulas, I know they offer meals, confinement nannies, especially I think California has a lot of them because it's a big Asian population there. And you hire them to stay with you for 30 days. They do, just like the confinement nannies in Asia, they do the cooking for the mother. They do very light household chores and they help with looking after the baby overnight so both parents can sleep. That's also the other important thing. It's, America has a long way to go, but I'm really hoping all the movements I'm watching can help in that side. But yeah, the partner can really step in to just really take up the load even for the 30 days, because if you just give your spouse that chance to recover, then at least, you know, when you start going back to work, because that's just the reality. Like, yeah, so the partner, I think, if they can organize the leave, which I know is rough, because if the mothers can't even get leave, don't know how much the fathers. The military is leading the way, though. They actually have January of last year, I think, they implemented a new rule military-wide. They have a 12-week parental leave. Even for people who adopt children, you can take that leave. So for birthing parents, you get your convalescent leave after giving birth. Then you can take the 12 weeks on top of that. And you know, we had some friends who were like, oh, do I really need 12 weeks? But yes, you need the 12 weeks. It's not a holiday. It's absolutely not a holiday. So I feel like this cultural practice is really an opportunity where modern postpartum care hasn't invited partners in. This is the perfect space to invite the partner. Even when you hire someone, this is something that I like to put it out there, that our confinement nannies and doulas, they're not just the help. They're there to teach you. They have the skills and they look after so many families. Like, make use of them to teach you and learn some things, because unless you can really afford to hire a nanny like forever, great, but most of us can't. So take this chance to upskill. I mean, and I mean the partner,
yeah.
The non-birthing parent, you know, take that chance to upskill, because y'all are going to, you know, take turns suffering through sleep deprivation and everything. I mean, you both have the skill and you can tag team, you learn how to navigate, or you learn especially your limit of what you can take. It'll all work out, you know, for the benefit of everyone.
Yeah, I think working as a unit that you have mentioned, I feel like really is the key in this very pivotal and very sensitive and vulnerable moment in time of post-birth, right? And the whole postpartum process. And I guess in relation to the confinement practice, if you think about it, the essence and the premise of confinement. And I feel like people who become parents assume definitely not just a different role as a parent, but the different dynamics within their friendships and even their other family members and even how they are at work. Like, I have a coworker who requests to be in a different room from us just so she could pump milk, right? So there's so many changes in here. So it's not quite surprising why there is so much talk when it comes to this whole process. And there's so much progress to be done, especially in America, especially for the mother too. You know, it is a man's world, especially it's a man's country here in the United States. And I know you're all the way on the other side.
Same.
Okay, never mind. So we're all living in the same land, the same world.
Man's world,
In your expertise and in your experience and in your practice within this whole space, I'm curious, what are your goals, not only within the confinement space, but within the healthcare and wellness space as a whole? You know, as we're talking, and I've noticed that you've been mentioning bridging so many things together and bridging different aspects and modalities of care. And it just clicked in my mind of like, oh, bridges in health. I guess to also tie all of this together, there's so many amazing topics. I guess what are your goals within this space? And I think in an ideal world that hopefully we can attain and we can make tangible, what do you want to see in the world? Or what do you want the world to adopt when it comes to not just postpartum and confinement, but also to family care in general?
I love that because that is my whole thing right now. It's interesting because when I started Bridges in Health, that was actually back in Germany. So we moved there in 2020. And that's when I was like, oh, I want to spin off and do my thing. And I kind of been playing with that idea already. And so for me personally, and that's why I don't want to super specialize in something. Confinement topic and all these stuff, to me, that's a passion type of thing because it's so related to my Malaysian-ness, so to speak. So to me, that's like a little baby I'll try to keep to myself forever rather than try to grow big and unleash it to the world and let other people partake in all that good stuff. So I see myself as that person to build the bridge to connect to audiences and kind of like, here, come meet, like, come together, let's have that conversation. I really loved your question because I feel like the whole world, we are not set up for families, whether it's families with children or just couples, or you are a caregiver. So, you know, let's start looking after parents of today. Maybe then their kids, I mean, it probably won't change a lot, but you have to invest long term. To me, I feel all the short term things, oh, I would throw money at you to have this or free daycare. Yeah, great. But long term, a lot of cultures are like, you know, men not participating in caregiving or think it's poor value and all those things. There's so much that needs to change to really encourage the younger generation to want kids. But at least in my area, what I can see is if I can do something in postpartum where we really care for the whole family, we start treating them right, then maybe it'll make it look desirable to the to my kids, at least, you know?
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely a whole nuance to that conversation. And there's definitely so many reasons why generations of today do not want to have kids. And definitely it's seeing and witnessing our parents suffering during our childhood of providing, or all the economic and logistical factors, and definitely many other things, especially women of today with the ever reduction in maternal care and in women's rights, especially here in America. And so there's definitely a lot of work to be done, but it's very reassuring that we have people like you who are kind of like lighthouses in this conversation of not just maternal care and postpartum care, but also, I guess, an advocate for the unit and in bridging people to others to see and foresee a world and view a world where we can all work hand in hand, especially within family units, to not just, you know, rejuvenate and after very traumatic experiences, pregnancy and childbirth, but also, just this mere fact of opening up those conversations that many may not want to talk about or who don't think about it, right? So it was such a great choice that you reached out to me because I am so honored. Because
no, it's honor is all mine. I have to say, no, the timing is great because I started talking more about this as well in Brussels in December because I am working very closely with the European Lifestyle Medicine Organization. And, you know, Dr. Johan Hannes, I call him my mentor in lifestyle medicine because he's an amazing guy. He started the whole European lifestyle medicine scene here and he's growing it so well. And he's really encouraging me to take postpartum however I want to, you know, or how I see it rather than try to, I guess, follow what's out there. And to me, when I brought up, you know, to the topic to the crowd and said, you know, postpartum really is a lifestyle. Not, I mean, of course, it's a nice little slide into lifestyle medicine, but it truly is because the minute you bring this baby home, your whole literal lifestyle changes because you got to follow your baby's schedule. That was a harsh awakening for me. Like I knew it, but to actually have that happen to me was a whole, like, what do you mean? I have to time my own like toilet breaks to like this and I got to work around their naps. I got to like, whoa, it was like a whole shift in the way I used to live. I couldn't live that way anymore. And that means my health, I didn't know how to I can't go for that yoga class anymore because it's their nap time. Like, what? I had to change so much in my lifestyle just to do that. But to me, I'm like, well, then what if I like certain other things? Then I can't do them anymore because now I'm a parent. Then that's not me. Then identity crisis is kind of thing. And
there's definitely a lot of psychological aspects to it as well. And it's definitely a conversation that I think is so important and definitely, oh my gosh, I think we'll have to do a part two for, oh my goodness.
Maybe for your next season or something.
I know.
When the theme aligns.
I know. Definitely all of these factors and especially within lifestyle medicine, there's a lot to talk about. And I hope that as we expect these topics to be included more into our daily conversation, especially within medicine, we also get to include conversations like confinement more into the healthcare space, especially here in America, because we're very centric in what we do. And so I'm so excited for so many of these sciences and also practices that practically I'm sure half of the American population has never heard of. And that's why it's such an honor that you are on today to help me talk all
Thank
about it.
Thank you so much.
I am so honored and I've been so excited for this talk. I honestly, my brain is like pounding with so much information and so much inspiration for this episode to reach not only my friends and my audience, but hopefully in the world that there is a space for recovery and there is a need and it is a necessity that we allow not only our mothers to rest after birth and after this whole tumultuous process, but also that we get to realize the roles that we have for our family members and the units and what they
Absolutely.
Can do for our mothers. So, Krista, thank you so much.
Thank you again, too. I love this.